This is the Observations Podcast for Sunday, the 7th of December, 2023. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dale Franks.
I'm Michael Wade, the only one on screen.
The only one on screen? Oh, well, I'm sure it looks like the only one on screen to you, but I can assure you on YouTube we are both on screen, so we're looking good on the live version. Administrative note, by the way, this is the last podcast of the year. We will do this podcast. There is a Christmas Eve that's coming up. We're not going to be here on Christmas Eve. And then the week after that is New Year's Day. We're not going to be here New Year's Day. So our next podcast after tonight is going to be January the 7th. So we are taking our usual three-week holiday hiatus, depending on where the dates fall. So just keep in mind that this is the last one of the year. So having said that, let's go out with a bang, shall we? And speaking of banging...
That's just gross.
And speaking of banging, I want to talk about Aidan Mays or Maisy Cherovsky, who was...
Yeah, I don't know how you say it.
Yeah. Well, when you see the name... You'll see it. He is the Senate staffer who somehow, I don't know how it got released. I'm not interested in going that into detail about the specifics of this, but basically he was caught having sex with another man in a Senate conference room inside the United States Capitol. And once... Oh. Well, he was
on film.
Yeah, on film. There was a video filmed of him receiving sex from another man in this Senate conference chamber or hearing chamber. And once it was released, of course, everybody, it's amazing how quickly they found out who this was. And he was fired by the senator for whom he worked. And so here was his response. That he posted to Twitter. This has been a difficult time for me, I'm sure, as I have been attacked for who I love to pursue a political agenda. Okay, you were filmed having sex in the United States Capitol. We'll get back to that. While some of my actions in the past have shown poor judgment, I love my job and would never disrespect my workplace. There is evidence that that is untrue. Any attempts to characterize my actions otherwise are fabricated, and I will be exploring what legal options are available to me in these matters.
Those would be none.
None. So, nice try. As for the accusations regarding Congressman Max Miller, I've never seen the congressman, had no opportunity or cause to yell or confront him. So, okay, that was another thing where some Senate staffer... basically said some anti-Semitic stuff to Congressman Max Miller. My interest in this is his response after being fired. Let us do him the courtesy of taking him at his word. And let's not assume that this is gaslighting, that he's just, you know, lashing out. Let's do him the courtesy of assuming that this is honest. And I want to do that because if this is an honest response, what it indicates to me about where our culture is frightening. Because what this screams to me is a lack of recognition that there are norms, that there are common standards that apply to everyone. And so if you break those norms and you get in trouble for it, you can't recognize, if you don't even see that those norms exist and that they apply to you and that they should apply to you, then getting in trouble and getting criticized and getting fired doesn't become the expected consequences of misbehavior. It becomes a unique persecution of you for what must be nefarious reasons. Because how, and even beyond that, it speaks to a narcissism that these common standards don't apply to me. and that what I did, no one who is reasonable could possibly have any disagreement with it. Therefore, the only reason why you might disagree with what I was, you know, caught doing is because you are a bad person, that you have, you know, some sort of personal vendetta or what have you against me, because no one could reasonably disagree that me having sex with someone else in a Senate chamber, I can't understand why anyone would ever have a problem with that. And if we take him at his word, and if he's honest, then what this says about where our culture is truly frightening.
Yeah, amongst young people especially. I mean, there's certainly been a concerted effort over several decades to tamp down and ultimately destroy those norms, you know, the societal norms. And we're in a very extreme part of that movement currently. You know, where boys can be girls, girls can be boys, blah, blah, blah. That something as personal as your sexual exploits whilst at work would be recorded, and that wouldn't be disrespectful to the workplace or anybody else. You have to be so far gone from, so far removed from the concept of societal norms that it's so completely foreign to you that you really honestly don't understand why people have a problem with this, unless, you know, it conveniently fits into your victim narrative.
Yeah. I mean, I will not say anything against someone who has privately photographed or filmed their personal sexual contacts with their significant other for whatever reasons. Don't care. I begin to care a little more if you've decided this is something that I'm so proud of, it needs to be posted publicly, because that just seems pretty icky and gross to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add on top of that, oh, and by the way, not only am I going to publicly post it, but I'm also going to do it in my workplace, where that sort of behavior is just not appropriate.
That happens
at all.
To be a public building owned by the public.
Owned by the
service of the public.
Yeah, owned by the United States people. I don't think our culture is in a good place. And here's why it worries me. And I was going to do this later because I wanted to go and cover this poll in more detail. However, I think part of it is very relevant, which is the Harvard-Harris poll that came out this week. And there are two things at the end of this poll. There is much more in this poll to discuss, but two things that I want to bring up at first. Two-thirds of voters, now this is a poll of thousands, I think 2,500 or so registered voters by the Harvard-Harris. Two-thirds of voters oppose an ideology that white people are oppressors. And almost 7 in 10 find this ideology hurtful to society. Unless you look way down here at the age breakout, where 79% of 18 to 24-year-olds think this is true, that white people are oppressors, and non-white people of certain groups have been oppressed and as a result should be favored today at universities for employment. 79% of 18-year-olds think that's true, or 18 to 24-year-olds. 49%, almost half, 50-50, well within the margin of error, of people 25 to 34 think that that is true. They are wildly outnumbered by people who are, you know, 35 and above. And then, are Jews as a class an oppressor class? Well, 67% of 18 to 24-year-olds say that they are. 44% of 25 to 34-year-olds say that they are. And then once again, once you get to 35 to 44, you get very large majorities who take the opposite view. What we are building is a society of young people whose views on our culture and our politics are diametrically opposed to the rest of the society that they inhabit.
That's correct.
And if you want to argue that these young people are not being indoctrinated, I've got bad news for you. They are.
Yeah, of course they are. And successfully and rapidly. They have a complete disconnect from reality. Matter of fact, reality is anathema to them. The only reality is their personal reality. Their, what do they always call it? Their lived experience. It's ridiculous. It's how you arrive at, well, you can't write about a black character in a book unless you're black. Well, I mean, literally for millennia, since the beginning of writing for other people to read, the idea was to appeal to something that was universally human. That's what made something more interesting and more people drawn to it, because it identified something that anybody can kind of tap into emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, whatever it is. I mean, that's what the great writers are composed of.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter anything else.
No. And by the way, this is the same generation who find ordering meals in a restaurant too frightening to contemplate.
Well, they've been taught to be scared all their freaking lives. I mean, that's all they get, are scaremongering. You know, I mean, back when I was a kid, we had it bad with, drugs and sex, you know, the AIDS epidemic, all that crap. Boy, that was fun in the 80s. I mean, they have it way worse. They've been told the world's going to collapse, and it's all these evil people who are going to collapse it around you for their own selfish reasons, and they eat this shit up. I mean, they've been presented with an existential crisis from the time they first started learning anything.
And scared people, and by the way, this is very important. This is why I think that the environmental doom and gloomism and all of that is intentional, because scared people are more willing to accept radical solutions than people who look around and go, you know what, my life is pretty okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic proved that, right? That was, I think, the most enlightening thing that came out of that whole ordeal, was how ready some people were to simply trust government and you throw common sense out the window, and everybody gets turned into a hater, a denier, or a good person, a virtuous person. It was the ultimate, black and white Manichaean world coming from the left. It just based on a really stupid hypothesis that a lot of people were like, well, wait, what? This stupid face diaper is going to actually prevent a disease that
is
way smaller than anything in here?
One of the weird things about COVID in 2020 were the number of people who were demonized for saying, look, we'll accept that COVID is dangerous. And we'll accept that there's a pandemic, which, I mean, it's not Ebola. Let's not lose our minds here. But the fact is, it's probably going to kill, half a percent to 1%, maybe even 2% of everybody who gets it, especially if you have comorbidities. So we got to do something about that. However, having said that, do we really want to just shut down the entire economy? All of these measures, are they really necessary? That was enough to get you banned off of social media. just merely questioning the U cases that came from NIH and the CDC was enough to have you put on as a bad person, even if you were to buy on to everything about COVID that we were told was true, and COVID is bad, and we've got to protect ourselves some way. Do we need a massive vaccination thing, or if we're going to vaccinate anybody, should we just concentrate on getting high-risk groups? Everybody else seems to be pretty safe from it. Anything like that. And don't even get started about, well, what are some existing things that might help? So, you know, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, whatever the effectiveness of those may be, we don't know because we were never allowed to look into it. Right? Any of that simply became heresy. I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, the secular religious or pseudo religious way that the government has started to operate in. All of that just became heresy. So even reasonable, hey, wait a second, are we following the best policies? No, we have to accept as a matter of orthodoxy that everything the government says is something that we have to do. They're the experts. They're the pros from Dover. They know best. It is not our place to question or detain them while they're going about their lawful occasions in controlling society. Super dangerous the way that response turned out.
Yeah, and also super harmful. I mean, more people died because of that response. Certainly more people have been left off way worse after the pandemic because of the actions taken by governments during the pandemic. You know, we basically killed off a good 2/3 of the economy. And we're fortunate enough to have about 1/3 of it spring back pretty quickly. But we're still working on that other 1/3, and it's getting harder and harder.
And the other thing about younger people too, because, you know, if you're 18 to 24 or even 18 to 35, but certainly 18 to 25. So let's take that. I have this theory. I was discussing this with Chris this week, and I've had this theory, and I've had it for a long time, which is the music that you respond to best for throughout your life tends to be that music that you liked when you were in high school and college. That music always tends to have a special place in your heart. That was the time when you had the most freedom and the least responsibility of your entire life. And so you always look back on that era with a lot of longing. I cannot to this day hear Joe Jackson stepping out without going into a deep nostalgic, a deep wave of nostalgia every time I hear that Joe Jackson song.
Melancholy.
It's not even melancholy. I just remember where I was when I heard it and what I was doing and where I worked. And again, I was a freshman in college when that song came out, and I was working at doing retail at a retail store. And, you know, my life basically consisted of going to college in the morning and going to work at this job that I liked and I was really good at in the afternoons and evenings. And for the most part, I was living on my own. I was going to the University of New Mexico, the San Juan campus in Farmington, New Mexico at the time. And that was just such a great time. And so I always like that music. So that time to me is kind of a special time, and I'll always regard that as great. But let's say that you were in high school or in college, you're a freshman in college, in 2020. Your memory of 2020 and 2021 and 2022 is probably going to be a far different sort of nostalgia when you reach your 40s. And I'm kind of curious as to how much damage we have done to everybody who is under 25 for, you know, those 2 years, 20 and 21 especially, but I mean, it continued into 22. How much did they lose? How will they look back on that? And how does that color their assessment of risk? And beyond that, what does that assessment of risk do to color their assessment of politics and policy?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think they have the skills to reason that through, to actually work that through. Matter of fact, I'm worried some of them won't be able to read it when they're 40, read the actual history. Schools, at least public schools, have, and some private schools, have just gone so all in on this, you know, making of the new socialist man, that they've basically even given up any pretense of teaching the three R's. Certainly in promoting any kind of proficiency in it. So what are these kids left with? I mean, raw ideas that they're told, you know, are absolutely correct and unchallengeable, and only bad people think otherwise.
And they're invariably political ideas. This is indoctrination. And look, California has the highest rate of illiteracy in the country. Fully 40%. I forget what the exact number was. I know we talked about it on the podcast a couple of months ago. 40% of California's high school graduates are functionally illiterate. And nearly 60% read at the fifth grade level or lower. These are not people, A, who are going to be reasoning from first principles. They are not people who have been taught first principles. They have not been taught logic. Whatever it is that they have been taught, it has not prepared them to become adults in a functioning, technologically advanced society. That terrifies the hell out of me.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of Brave New World, how people were basically trained from a young age to fulfill a slot of, you know, and that's what you did. And that was just your vocation forever. That's how you helped everybody out, comrade.
And the frightening thing about this is, and this is one of the things that I've hated about the right for a long time, and we've talked about before, is this isn't fixable through politics. Certainly not presidential politics, you know, and I see so many people, you know, online and social media and elsewhere who have convinced themselves that Donald Trump will fix this, that Donald Trump is the kind of fighter who will come back and fix this. I have bad news for you. This is not fixable by the federal government. This is not fixable by any president. This is a cultural problem, and the only way to fix it is by retaking control of the cultural institutions that have produced it in the first place. And it's going to be a long, hard struggle, and it's going to take a generation or two to overturn it. And you know, this concentration on whoever, I don't care who you support, Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, it doesn't matter. They're not going to fix it. They're not going to change it. They are incapable of doing so because this is not going to be fixed through a political solution. Now, at the local level,
it might be. School boards and whatever.
Yeah, school boards and whatever. I mean, if I was looking into politics right now and trying to change politics, I would ignore the federal government entirely. I consider the federal government at this point a lost cause, and it'll be a lost cause until there is enough change at the local level to force a change on the federal government. Washington, D.C. is corrupt, it's incompetent, and it's malevolent. And there's nothing that we can do and no candidate who will change that and who will turn that around. What you might turn around is your local school board. What you might turn around is your city council. And starting at that grassroots level and then going after the school board is important because it goes after a cultural institution that needs to be reformed. And then moving up into the state, maybe you can begin to affect what's going on at, you know, the college regents level. But thinking that Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis or Joe Biden is going to fix this or return us to normalcy or whatever it's going to be, I got bad news for you. That's not going to happen.
No, the one thing that someone like that can do is at least kill off the sustenance, end the federal support of these types of programs.
Yeah, briefly, for a time. I mean, they can fight.
At least cutting off money, cutting off attention, forcing states to do these things, that would be a help.
Sure, you can fight.
But other than that, rear guard action. You're right. This is a cultural thing. But if we could remove those extra cultural supports, that would be helpful.
Yeah, the trouble is that anything that a president or even Congress can do can simply be undone by the next president or the next Congress. There are right. No permanent victories available in Washington, D.C. Sure, you could fight a rear guard action for 4 years. Maybe. If you had the Congress and if you had the president, and by the way, if 2/3 of Congress weren't, so corrupt that they'll sign on to whatever the DC consensus is in the first place, maybe you could fight a rear guard action. I mean, it's beginning to look like, when you look at the 1980s and you look at Ronald Reagan, it's beginning to look like that was really a rear guard action. It worked great to delay stuff for another decade or two. Until the whole memory of Reaganism just sort of seeped out of public consciousness and into history.
Well, and Reagan was known for his fiscal constraint. He was in some areas, but we certainly didn't hold the line.
He tripled the national debt in 8 years. So, So it was a rear guard action in some ways. And look, it was effective for a while. I remember Bill Clinton going out on his State of the Union address and saying, the era of big government is over, and getting a standing ovation from both sides of the House. So that certainly seeped in for a while, but jump forward 20 years, and there's Barack Obama, who's going to fundamentally transform the country. You don't fundamentally transform.
Bush before him.
Yeah, you don't fundamentally transform something that you love and that you think is working well.
That's exactly right. I mean, and even George Bush, the son, was like, "Well, we have to control capitalism to save it, or we have to undermine it to save it." Whatever you said, collapse, the financial collapse was beginning. So it was like 2007, 2008. And I mean, it hasn't had anything really to do with party politics as to how we've ended up in this mess. It has to do with the political culture. And they're perfectly happy to keep spending money that we don't have. As long as they have it to spend, they can keep buying votes with it. And it's ultimately somebody else's problem way down the wrong line.
Yeah, and by the way, one can make an argument, and a fairly good argument too, that the inflation that we're experiencing now isn't Joe Biden's fault, or certainly not Joe Biden's fault alone. It's Donald Trump's fault as well. Donald Trump didn't trim the budget. Donald Trump added trillions to the national debt while he was president. And all of that adds up. And of course, it's not just Donald Trump, because go back to Barack Obama, who added over the course of 8 years, nearly $10 trillion from.
He doubled, nearly doubled the national debt from the time he entered office to the time he left.
Yeah, it is so easy to spend money that you don't have. And it is so attractive that that both Republicans and Democrats find it impossible to do. And then go back before Obama, go back to 2008, and go back to George W. Bush. Here's $800 billion we're just going to dump in a day because we don't want the banks to collapse. Remember, they're too big.
We don't want our friends to go without a job.
Yeah, they're too big to fail. And so we're reaping the benefits of not just Democrats, not just Joe Biden, but both Republican and Democratic presidents and Congresses run by Republicans and Democrats since 2001, where if any money needs to be spent, Congress and the president are more than happy to spend it. Their priorities have differed from administration to administration, but they have taken us from $12 trillion to $30 trillion in national debt. And we're starting to see, you know, like an asymptotic curve of national debt just shooting up. You know, we talked about that last week when we looked at the debt service on national debt, which is now, you know, close to $1 trillion per year just in debt service. It exceeds the entire U.S. defense budget. That's not sustainable, but we have managed to build that by both Republicans and Democrats. And that's why I whenever I look at these cultural issues, I've given up on Washington. Washington is not going to fix anything, at least not until it is forced to. And it won't be forced to until there is enough change in the political culture at the grassroots level that begins to filter up to the federal level.
Well, and that's what makes it so hard. And that's how the left has been so successful, is by having such capture of those institutions, especially media. You know, TV shows, movies, commercials, fashion, whatever it is, certainly TV news and your major newspapers.
Well, NBC, perfect
example. Stories told all the time.
Perfect example. The staffer, NBC's report, NBC's headline for this report, whenever he got fired, was "Staffer linked by conservative news outlets to sex tape." You know, leaves Senate. Wait a second. What's this linked to a sex tape by conservative news outlets? I mean, that is such a fundamental misstatement of the facts of the story that there is no way that headline could have been written honestly.
Right. Well, it's clearly supposed to cast an eye of aspersion at the Daily Caller Foundation. And it's somewhat dubious call to actually air this video. I'm not sure why they did that, but this doesn't have anything to do with partisanship.
By the way, just as an aside, I should tell you in chat, tell Michael his hair looks good too.
Why? Because I was messing with it.
I just wanted to pass that compliment along.
I don't know. I forget what I was saying. Like Joe Biden. Anyway.
Yeah, man. It says $300 billion, $11,000 million. Poor fella.
Anyway.
Some other people have run into trouble this week. And it's interesting. This all happened this week. First of all, Rudy Giuliani got socked with a $148.1 million damage verdict in...
Wait, no, it was 1.5, wasn't it?
No, $148.1 million in damages.
Oh, $148 million.
Yeah, $148.1 million. I'm going to assume Rudy Giuliani doesn't have $150 million.
No, I'm really doubting it.
This is for the two poll workers in Atlanta who a video was released, which I am told was a deceptively edited video.
Of course.
And you can believe as much of that as you want. But in any event, he said that they were, you know, ballot stuffing and that they were passing some sort of USB drive to each other in this video. They're saying the USB drive was a mint, whatever. A jury in D.C., so we'll see how that holds up on appeal. But a jury in D.C. basically just said, yeah, he slandered these two women. They won their defamation lawsuit, and he now has a $148.1 million judgment that is now pending.
How did they even come up with that number? It's not like
75 of it
is women.
75 of it is punitive damages.
Yeah, but still, it's not like these women would have ever made that much money. Even if they hit the lottery, they still wouldn't have made that much money.
Yes. Well, again, a DC jury. So they were very generous to these two women. However,
easy to spend other people's money.
In addition to that, Sidney Powell and Kenny Chesbro had to make a plea deal in Georgia, with Sidney Powell pleading down to 6 misdemeanor accounts and Kenny Chesbro pleading guilty to 1 felony charge of conspiracy to commit filing false documents, for Sidney Powell conspiring to intentionally interfere with the performance of election duties. So they have accepted their plea deals, and as part of it, they were supposed to write an apology. Their apologies were, shall we say, terse in their phrasing. But hey, as we always used to say in the military, the minimum standard has to be good enough or it wouldn't be the minimum standard. So there we go. All 3 of them are now receiving pretty negative consequences based on the claims that they made in their post-election lawsuits, which, you know, for whatever reason, if you ask Rudy Giuliani, and he was asked about this, why, if you had all this proof, why didn't you present it? His excuse was the judge wouldn't accept it. And I guess that brings up the possibility of appealable error. Because, you know, look, at the appeals level, the appeals courts may trim that verdict back a little bit, but they're not going to overturn it. The jury is the finder of fact. So
it's very hard to overturn. An appellate court is always going to be incredibly reluctant to overturn a jury's verdict. The only real situations are if there was perhaps perjury on the stand proved, or a mistake of law was made in like the jury instructions or something like that. That could overturn, because then it's not the jury's fault that they reached that conclusion. It was that they were not instructed properly.
Yeah. Again, we get back to appealable error.
Yeah. And so it's going to have to be something that the judge did. And I think there are probably some, there are some issues there that are appealable. But it, you know, they're not going to change. They may do some sort of remittiture as far as the amount of the damages, say, well, you really can't get more than this. And that may reduce it significantly, but still it's going to be a lot. It's just a question of whether or not it's a good verdict or not.
Yeah. I mean, let's say they reduce it by, you know, a substantial amount, you know, more than like 80%. Okay. If you're going to reduce it by 80%, that's still going to be, you know, $28 million.
Yeah. It's nothing to shake a stick at.
And Rudy Giuliani doesn't have $28 million.
No. And I really don't think he knows anybody who's going to give it to him right now. No, but the only thing really is going to have to be a very definable, you know, legal mistake or situation. And they're going to have to then rule that the judge was arbitrary and capricious.
Yeah. Unfortunately, neither Sidney Powell or Kenneth Chesbro are going to have that argument available for,
well, they did a plea deal. So it doesn't matter.
Right. They've done a plea deal. They've now pleaded guilty to,
right. So they can't appeal that.
So, you know, they're done now, you know, it's just all 3 of them were very big on their claims of election interference, and they have all been, I mean, professionally, they've basically been professionally destroyed at this point.
Yeah. Giuliani, I don't know, didn't surprise me that much. Sidney Powell, I was really surprised at what she did. She had a pretty sterling reputation until this, and she just went way overboard. And I don't know what her thinking was, but something sparked it. I don't know what it was. And she kind of went into crazy town, the Kraken and all that.
Yeah. But here's the thing. Do you remember after the 2020 election, we had a podcast, you know, that next week when we were doing the podcast on Fridays. So it was 4 days after the election. And both of us looked at those election results and both of us said, okay, Joe Biden got 81 million votes. Joe Biden won votes that Obama carried by, you know, 60%. And Joe Biden got 70. Joe Biden polled better than Barack Obama. It looked weird.
And he had no coattails.
Yeah, and that was the other thing. He had no coattails. Now, I seem to remember my analysis was, look, we can't explain this. People just, especially suburban voters, and oh God, especially suburban women voters, they just hate Donald Trump. And so even if they're generally in, you know, supportive of the policies, they just really thought he was a bad messenger. And it could be explained that way because Joe Biden won and he didn't take anybody into the House or the Senate with him. That it just seemed like a super weird election. And I remember us talking about it the week after that, you know, I'm not saying I remember, I think I even said words to the effect of, I'm not saying Joe Biden didn't get 81 million votes. I'm just saying that's a lot of votes.
Yeah. That's a suspiciously large amount.
But, you know, Giuliani, Powell, Chesbrough, the way they went about it just didn't make much sense to me. If you're going to walk into federal court and you're going to start slinging around accusations, you better have some proof. Even if we were to assume, arguendo, that this level of cheating occurred, and that B, they were aware of this level of cheating. Like we always used to say when I was a military policeman, it doesn't matter what you know. It only matters what you can prove.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's harder to get evidence in than people think. I mean, you have to, in order to introduce evidence into a trial, it has to meet the definition of evidence. Can't run afoul of any rules of evidence, like hearsay, for example, although there are lots of exceptions. But you also have to introduce it. So if I've got a bloody glove, I have to have some way to introduce that glove. I can't just say, here's a bloody glove. It's, you know, the defendant's. You have to have, you know, who found it, establish where they found it, when they found it, document what happened, if they've tested it. Like, you have to do all that stuff in order to get that information in. So you have to lay a foundation or res gestae in order to introduce evidence. And that's sometimes easier said than done. It's much easier said when you're just telling the story, but you can't, that's not how a trial works. You actually have to have verifiable evidence in order to even introduce it. So it's not as cut and dried as a lot of people might think.
Yeah. Well, speaking of courts and evidence, this came up this week. The Supreme Court did something that I find very interesting after a very bitterly divided appeals court took a look at this issue. The Supreme Court is going to hear a January 6th case about this whole theory that the prosecution has pushed for many of the J6 prosecutions, which is this obstruction of an official proceeding charge. And what that statute actually says, vice what federal prosecutors are saying it says. And at the appeals level, there's been some pretty deep disagreement about whether that charge can be supported for these J6 cases. And so the Supreme Court is going to take it. And what I think is fascinating about this is Donald Trump is being charged for this as well. Mm-hmm. And so if the Supreme Court says that that is not a valid charge, the actual statutory language of the obstructing an official proceeding statute, then all of those J6 cases, at least all of those convictions, that means that we are going to have a shitstorm of appeals for all of those cases. And of course, what that means is if you are currently trying Donald Trump on that, that charge has to go away, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so what that means for in the short term is that they're looking to have like a March trial, I believe. Or maybe it's May, but there's no way they're going to be able to do that. They're going to have to wait until the Supreme Court rules. And that ruling, I don't think, unless it's on an emergency basis, wouldn't come out until like June. So there's no way they're going to be able to get the trial.
Well,
Chutkin is going to have to award a continuance until the Supreme Court rules.
Yeah, and when will it, first of all, when will there even be oral arguments on that case if the Supreme Court is just taking it on their normal docket?
Yeah, it's going to be in the winter term.
Yeah, I mean, those oral arguments are not going to take place until
February, March, something like that.
Yeah, and then
maybe April even.
And by the way, you say the Supreme Court wouldn't return until June. It might be substantially later than June. When does the Supreme Court actually break?
The winter term decisions come out usually in June. So they'll be, and sometimes late May, but it's basically June is when you get the bulk of the decisions, and you'll get all of them before July begins.
Okay. Well, that doesn't give us enough time to actually run a trial then.
No.
And the interesting thing is what the feds have been trying to do is get into a trial and get Donald Trump convicted prior to the election.
Exactly.
That's the whole thing here. This throws a huge monkey wrench into that because either you have to drop that charge and prosecute him on the other charges to try to get into a courtroom, or you have to wait.
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't see how they can't wait. Because they're not going to drop the charges. That's they've come this far. They're going to get their conviction eventually. What good it'll do them, I don't know. But they're not going to just let it go. They've come this far. If anything, it might spark him to try a few more lawsuits. Who knows?
Yeah, I have to go back and look at what he's being charged with, but I think that's the primary felony, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's the only felony. Well, let's see. This is the Jack Smith case, right?
Yeah.
So I can't remember. Is Jack Smith also handling the documents, National Archives part of it?
I can't remember either because the J6 thing did not occur to me when I was doing show prep. So I'm basically trapped on what I see right now in front of me at this moment. So I don't know. And I would have to actually go back.
I do know that he is charged with, seditious conspiracy? Is that what the charge was for some of the J6ers? I think Jack Smith has leveled some sort of similar charge at him. Maybe it's a conspiracy charge with that being the underlying.
Well, yeah,
felony, I don't know.
The Oath Keepers guys that got convicted were convicted on seditious conspiracy, or at least
I think that's the charge that's being challenged.
All right. Well, that's going to be interesting to see because that's going to put. What happens if Trump becomes the nominee, he wins the election, and then gets convicted of a felony?
Just pardon himself, I suppose.
How does that play? Well, that's true. If he's elected president, No president has ever done it for obvious political reasons. But I would not put it past Donald Trump to just pardon himself. I pardon myself for all crimes I have or may have committed in connection with January 6th. And we'll
commit in the next 24 hours.
And we'll commit. Yeah, that, you know.
I can do that, right? I have that ability.
Here's the thing. Constitutionally, as far as I can tell.
I don't think there's any problem with that.
As far as I can tell, other than in cases of impeachment, which is the only limitation on the president's pardon power in the Constitution, the president can pardon anybody for anything. It is a plenary power, at least according to the text of the Constitution.
Well, except for, like you said, in cases of impeachment. That's the only circumscription on it.
Yeah, in fact, there was a case in the 1800s, a pardon case, and the Supreme Court just flatly came out and said it. Other than in cases of impeachment, the president has, and they didn't use the term plenary, but they basically said the president can do whatever, pardon anybody he wants for anything he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how you
and
end up.
And that's traditionally how pardon power has always been used.
Yeah. And so what you end up with is like Jimmy Carter. I mean, and I have seen a lot of people, especially on the left, who have said, well, you know, somebody has asked, well, actually, some Trump people have actually said this too. Why didn't Trump pardon the J6 people? Well, he was told he couldn't do that and that he had to know the, you know, specific name and the specific crime. No, he didn't. Because Jimmy Carter tritty trotted into the Oval Office and said, hey, if you may or may not have burned your draft card or fled to Canada to avoid the
draft. Have you been living in Canada for a while?
Yeah.
Maybe it's time you come back home.
Come on. You're pardoned. We will not know everyone who, and that's the other thing. They always say that if you accept a pardon, you're admitting guilt for maybe kind of, but if there's a blanket pardon issued by the president, like Jimmy Carter did for the Vietnam War draft dodgers, you don't have to admit to anything. He just said, yeah, come on back from Alberta. Nobody's going to bother you. You did it. You got off scot-free. You're pardoned. So, yeah, Trump could pardon himself. And by the way, even though I just said that no president has ever even tried to do that, A, no president has needed to other than Dick Nixon. And even Dick Nixon knew that that would be, you know, politically unsurvivable. Although, you know, I kind of wish he had just to rub it in their faces. I do not see Donald Trump being troubled by that consequence.
I don't either. I think he'd be absolutely happy to shove it in people's face.
Oh, yeah. He would pardon himself, and then he would say, what are you going to do about it? I'm president. Impeach me. Wait, again?
Come beat this shit up.
Go ahead.
And then I'll pardon myself again.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
I'll just wake up every day and pardon myself for yesterday.
But if the Supreme Court comes down, as certainly half of the appeals courts have, of saying that this interpretation of that obstruction of official proceeding statute has been misapplied.
Yeah. It came out of Sarbanes-Oxley or something.
Yeah.
Sarbanes-Oxley or...
It was part of Sarbanes-Oxley. Yeah. So if this gets turned over, that means a lot of people now get to just walk free, doesn't it? Because all these people who were convicted on that, all these J6 people, I mean, this was one of the primary charges that the Department of Justice has relied upon. And first of all, I think we would also want to know who signed off on this idea that that was an acceptable charge.
It had to be the at least the district attorney,
U.S. attorney.
If not Merrick Garland himself. Matter of fact, I would think Merrick Garland would have to sign off on something that high a charge.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say for something that and that in the Congress itself. Capitol Police, they're all federal charges. I would think Merrick Garland would have to sign off on that. but for an absolute certain that the USAD had to.
Yeah, and it is interesting.
And we saw where his sympathies lie.
Yeah, well, I think it's also interesting that there is such deep disagreement in among, you know, federal judges as to whether that is appropriate or not. And I bet if we were to go through and look at who appointed those judges on each side, we would not be surprised.
At the district court level, the president doesn't really have any choice in that. It's the senators who control that.
Yeah. So yeah, largely that is true. But I'm talking about the appellate level, because it's at the appellate level.
That makes a bigger difference. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the appellate level where there's been a disagreement as to whether that is a proper or an improper charge, which is, by the way, why the Supreme Court has to take it. Because they now have to clear up that issue in the federal system, because there's now a dichotomy. And it's just interesting how it plays out based on who appointed the appellate court justices as to whether they feel this was a good use of that statute or a bad use. Anyway, before we go, I did want to cover this, and there's a whole bunch that we could talk about. Again, this is the Harvard-Harris poll. We did this last quarter, so it's a very similar poll. 2,034 registered voters were interviewed about this, and
can you make it so I can see this with everybody else?
I'm showing the browser window. But if I share it with you, you will disappear. I thought you could see this. You can't see this in Zoom?
No, all I see is Dale Franks.
That is odd, because I thought in Zoom you saw... Oh, I know what your problem is.
Ah, there he goes. My problem.
I just fixed you. I didn't start the video in the Zoom meeting.
Uh-huh.
So you are not looking at anything but my name on the screen. Okay.
That's all I had to concentrate on.
I am sorry about that. Now you can concentrate on other things, including this, now that you can see it. So, approval and mood of the country. Mood ain't great. 62% of respondents say that the country is on the wrong track. They have not thought that the country was on the right track since back in, back during the summer, when it briefly rose above the wrong track. And this goes back, you know, quite a long time on a monthly basis, where people are just not happy with the way things are going. Only 1 in 3 say the economy is on the right track. So once again, when you just talk about the economy specifically, 59% say it's on the wrong track. Perceptions of the economy remain low. Only 44% saying it is strong today. Again, 56% disliking it. And about half of voters say their personal financial situation is worsening. 49% say that things are worse. So if you want to understand why something we talked about a week or two ago about how the House Democrats are abandoning the Bidenomics tagline for re-election, this is why. Bidenomics doesn't look super popular when you start seeing how people are assessing the economy. With all of this said, more Americans are optimistic rather than pessimistic about their life over the next year.
That's America.
So, yeah, everything sucks, but it's going to get better. 47% are feeling optimistic about their lives over the next year, even though 2/3 of them say the economy sucks.
They're expecting some really good Christmas presents.
That Christmas bonus must be key for many of these people.
That's going to turn everything around.
We're going to turn this thing around. Okay, Biden approval. 43% this month, with only 20% strongly approving. So Joe Biden, not super popular.
I go with super popular.
Popular.
That sounds like something that Biden could at least pull off.
Yeah, well, it sounds like something he should say, sadly, or would say. Everything. Nobody. There is a majority of people who give him good marks on reacting to coronavirus. How valid that is in 2023, I'm not sure. But in everything that matters now, the economy, jobs, terrorism, immigration, he doesn't have a majority approval rating anywhere. And on immigration, it's below 40%, as it is on inflation. So those are his two super weak issues across the board with everybody. But do we like the GOP? Barely. 51 to 49% is GOP as positive. All right. Well, do we like the Democrats? Well, 53 to 47%. I'm going to think that both of these numbers are within the margin of error. So, so basically, it's 50-50 GOP approval, 50-50 Democratic approval. How much do we like Congress? About one-third likes Congress. Two-thirds of people think Congress is a bunch of losers, and I find
Do they do their own congressman one here?
No, I actually don't think they do.
That's usually the follow-up question.
Yeah.
How about your own senator? How about your own representative?
Yeah, your own representative is always like 80%. Yeah, our guy is good. It's the other 433 losers who are in the House of Representatives that are assholes. So the most popular people, RFK Jr., Elon Musk, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Nikki Haley have the highest net approval ratings. Donald Trump's gap is 1%, so he doesn't have a lot of big approval. But he does have 49% approval among those who are polled. And you compare that to Joe Biden with 43% approval among those polled. Interestingly, Biden's disapproval numbers are at 53%, 5 points higher than Donald Trump. So he's underwater by 10%. Joe Biden, currently not popular. Is that simply because he happens to be president right now, and so he's the guy that gets the blame, and that if he leaves, he will be seen in retrospect more on like Donald Trump? I mean, Donald Trump is 50-50, right? And those are probably really strong 50-50.
Because he's a polarizing guy.
Yeah, so those are strong 50-50s, I'm sure.
Who's that has the highest disapproval there?
Hunter Biden.
Yeah. Oh, Hunter Biden, okay.
Yeah, with a net minus 41% approval rating. And look, when it comes to the list of people shown here, it's hard to argue that there are many people who deserve a higher disapproval rating than Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
Our most favorable institutions in the United States military, the police, and Facebook. okay. I mean, the implication on the number of people who like cute kitty videos is really astounding on this. So Facebook has a higher approval rating than, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court or the Department of Justice. Worst on this is China at minus 51%. Well, there's also Hamas at minus 51%. But China and Hamas have the lowest approval ratings on here. Will that affect U.S. policy? Will it affect Joe Biden's policy? Probably not. But I think it's an interesting thing to look at how badly people perceive China. And you and I have talked before about how bad our China policy is and how some sort of decoupling from China and a reorientation towards our hemisphere might be a better policy. It'll never happen, but I tell you what, it sure looks like it'd make a lot of people happy if it did.
Yeah.
Top issue, inflation. followed by immigration, both of which are up over the last
and connected
survey. Yeah, and connected.
And that's our economy and jobs.
Yeah, so that's what people care about. So price increases and inflation and immigration. Oh, and by the way, basically Jerome Powell came out this week without saying it, at least indicated, we're going to have to start letting up on interest rates.
Yeah, I can't believe that. They say they're going to have three cuts next year.
Yeah, wait, you know why? Because there's an election coming up.
Yeah, exactly. They're making money as free as possible. But the rates on those, or the yields on the bonds are going to be ridiculous.
That doesn't matter. We're gonna reduce interest rates and we're going to ease up the money supply prior to the election. And then if we have to come back and address inflation, we will. But and this is one of the interesting things. If you look back, and there have been very few times in history when it's been different. But if you look back, the 1970s springs immediately to mind. How interest rates began to tumble in presidential election years. The Fed knows what side of the bread is buttered. I'll just say that. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like they're going to do it again, which means probably next year we're going to be right back in inflation territory, which is not to say that we aren't now. We're just at inflation at a lesser rate than it has been. I wouldn't be surprised to see inflation.
The rate of change has slowed, but still going up.
Yeah, and I would expect.
I just do want to point to one thing here, that healthcare is what, the 1, 2, 3, like the sixth most important?
Yeah.
And we still haven't gotten rid of Obamacare. And the stories and advertising and whatever else I keep hearing are about how the healthcare system is failing and not taking care of the people it's supposed to and blah, 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 blah. It's like, well, you guys got Obamacare. What the else do you want? You've already basically taken over, a sixth of the economy. Now what?
Yeah, and you told me this would
give
fix
everything
it.
To you.
Yeah, you said this would fix it, and turns out, it didn't. Doesn't matter what side of you're on. 47% say inflation is the most important problem on the GOP side. 42% independents.
Yeah.
31% Democrats. So, Democrats apparently a little more amenable to inflation. All right, so midterms and horse race. Not much that I want to say about this, but 62% of the voters have doubts about Joe Biden's fitness. Although 66% of Democrats say, no, he's mentally fit. So 66% of Democrats are lying to themselves. Is Joe Biden too old? 64% say he's showing too old. But again, this 36% is largely Democrats. 67% say he is fit to be president. So that's big. Independents, of course, largely disagree as well. Is Biden worsening rather than improving? 24% say Biden is getting better. That's Democrats. Half 45% of Democrats say, no, Joe Biden is getting even better than he was. 48% say he is getting worse. Even 17% of Democrats say he's getting worse. But again, all partisan divide on this. Will Trump be convicted? Did he commit crimes? Do you think Donald Trump has committed crimes for which he should be convicted, or is he not committed any crimes? 82% of Democrats say he has committed crimes. 27% of the GOP say he has committed crimes, but 73% say he has not. 60%.
Actually, that independent. Yeah, that's the scarier number for Trump.
Yeah, that's the, because
I think the independents.
Yeah. We tend to think of America as being a two-party country. There's Democrats and there's Republicans. But if you actually start looking at voter registration and voter behavior, it's really about 25% Republican, 25% Democrat. Well, let's say 30% Republican, 30% Democrat, and 40% independent. Independents are the big number now in American elections. Didn't used to be that way. As recently as 20 years ago, we didn't even really care that much about independents. Independents made up about 20% of the electorate. That has doubled, I believe, since 2000. So we're looking at 40% of the electorate saying they're independents. When 40% of the electorate are saying you have committed crimes, that doesn't make a general election look like a cakewalk. Because you're going to have to win a big number of these. Do you think Donald Trump is a threat to democracy if he's elected president? I think there's a lot of pants wetting about this question. However,
I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
You know, he'll declare himself president for life, and we'll all or whatever. We'll all have to just accept it. I'm not sure how that would work out. I'm not sure who would support him being president for life or what he would do to threaten democracy. But golly, 82% of Democrats say he's a threat to democracy. 81% of GOP people say he is not a threat. But again, here is the big number. It's a dead 50-50 split among independents.
Yeah, that's a little worrisome.
Again, for a general election, when 40% of the electorate identify as independents.
And let's face it, this is not an unknown quantity. He's already been president for 4 years. And that people are still worried that he might do all these crazy things after 4 years of having the power and not doing the crazy things, that you still believe half and half that it's possible.
Yeah, look,
not good for Trump.
Yeah, but again, we were told that he was going to be some sort of authoritarian back in 2016.
Yeah.
He turned out not to be.
Not even close.
Indeed, Donald Trump, in his execution of executive authority, was notably less activist than Obama or George H.W. Bush. And in fact, there were several instances in which people were saying, how come you don't sign an executive order on this? And he said, that's Congress's job.
Right.
So this Trump is a boogeyman threat to democracy argument is one that I find really hard to swallow. If he was going to take over and he had planned to take over, I'm sure he'd have figured it out from 2016 to 2020. And he would have prevented himself from losing the 2020 election.
Yep.
I don't know. Here's the thing. Most of the time, people who are authoritarians and who intend to be dictators tend to be really good organizers and tend to be pretty detail-oriented. I'm not sure that Donald Trump has the personality that is inclined towards being able to effectively become an authoritarian dictator. But 82% of Democrats and 19% of the GOP apparently disagree with me on that. I just think that is a tempest in a teapot argument. I don't think Donald Trump is going to show up if he gets reelected on January 21st wearing a junta colonel's uniform and awarding himself medals and deciding he's going to be president for life. And besides, even if he did, he's
we
almost...
don't have to listen to him.
Yeah, and he's almost 80 years old. So, You know, he's going to be limited by biology for taking over. Anyway, Trump, clear favorite in the GOP primary. Among GOP voters, 67% say if the 2024 election was held today, they would vote for Donald Trump. Second choice, Ron DeSantis. GOP primary, first or second choice among GOP voters, Donald Trump, 74%. Don't know if that's true or not. Don't know if that'll be borne out whenever we walk into Iowa and we see what actually happens there. Maybe. We'll see. But, you know, how much of this is just support for Donald Trump because they just will not stop going after him?
No.
And whether they should go after him or not, by the way, is completely beside the point. The fact is they are going after him, and so he's politically benefiting from that. Harris remains the top prospective nominee for the Democrats if Biden doesn't run. Well,
and who's the second?
Hillary Clinton coming in at number two, followed closely by Bernie Sanders. Whew, that is a list of winners right there.
Pete Buttigieg makes it.
Yeah. Also, Pete Buttigieg, 5%, just ahead of someone else. So Pete Buttigieg and anybody is now running neck and neck. Everybody else, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Manchin, all the other people, they can't even muster enough support to beat anybody. So someone else doing really well in the prospective nomination for the Democratic nomination for president. A majority of voters are open to an independent moderate candidate in the event of a Trump-Biden rematch. 58% of Democrats say they would consider independent. 48% of the GOP and 65% say that they would support an independent. Overall, 58% of voters say they would consider supporting an independent candidate in the case.
That's a big number.
Yeah, in the case of a Biden-Trump race, because two-thirds of the country don't want either of those two people running for president. And this has not changed since we looked at this a quarter ago. Two-thirds of the voters do not want this presidential campaign, not the one that we're shaping up to get.
That's the only thing that gives me hope.
Yeah, that two-thirds of the country are wishing emeralds on both their houses.
Yeah.
And it's a majority across the board. By the way, 67% of Democrats are saying that. Now, that is substantially more than the 52% of the GOP that is saying that. So the GOP is better with Trump than they are with Joe Biden. But whenever your own party is saying, yeah, we need somebody else other than these two guys.
Yeah.
And 72% of independents. I'm just looking at time and how much we have. Trump remains ahead of Biden in the head-to-head matchup. It's a national poll. It is also a year prior to the election. This is largely meaningless. Trump also ahead in a three-way race with RFK Jr., political neophyte. No support. He's not going to run, so I don't even know why we're asking this question. And if you throw in Jill Stein and Cornel West, those political powerhouses, Trump still maintains the lead. I mean, this is like asking, you know, which imaginary character would be better as president? Because it's just as likely to happen.
Picking the genie.
Yeah. Biden has a slight edge over DeSantis and is tied with Haley in head-to-head races. Again, national poll, a year prior to the election. Who knows? We'll know next September when we actually have a race. And your opinion means something, whether these things are true. Almost 3 in 4 voters think Biden is unlikely to fulfill a second term. 56% Donald Trump will act like a dictator if reelected. However, 60% still miss Donald Trump's policies on the economy, immigration, and crime. So sure, he might be a dictator, but
he was our dictator.
But he was a good dictator. A vote for Joe Biden is really a vote for Kamala Harris because he will likely not serve a second term. 72% believe that is true. Yeah, he's 80-some years old. Yes, it is very likely he will not finish a second term.
Which means that it's also likely that Kamala Harris will be vice president for much longer.
Yeah, I mean, biology is a thing. So... half of voters say they're worse off during Biden's presidency. 3 in 5 say they were better off under Trump. there is a, this obviously happened before this week when Hunter Biden told the Congress to go screw, but there was strong consensus that Hunter Biden should have appeared for a deposition by Congress. But fortunately, he had Eric Swalwell help him get out of that. 7 in 10 voters think Hunter Biden should be prosecuted, including if he refuses to appear before a deposition, including 54% of Democrats. So, okay. Foreign aid. Okay, this is going to be another weird one here. 2/3 of voters believe the U.S. should be supporting Ukraine and Israel in their conflict.
The same number.
Yeah. Well, man, there's some difference here. But as far as Ukraine goes, 77% of Democrats, 56% of Republicans, 60% of independents. We should support Ukraine. 63% of Democrats support Israel, 71% of the GOP, 61% independent and others. Okay, great. So if we should, and this is where it gets interesting. Do you believe the U.S. should be supporting Ukraine in its Russia, in its war against Russia, or not supporting the Ukraine? Well, again, 65% say, yeah, we should support Ukraine. Okay, great. Do you support or oppose $50 billion in additional aid to Ukraine to help win its war in Russia? Well, not so fast. I mean, we should support them, but, you know, there should be limits. And so 63% support the Ukraine aid bill, 64% of Republicans oppose, 53% of independents oppose the additional $50 billion. So that's a weird dichotomy. Yes, we all believe we should support Ukraine because it makes me a good person, I guess. We just don't think we should support them with, you know, money. I guess that for most people, that support equates to moral support. However, at the same time, you know, a bare majority supports the $14 billion aid package to Israel in its war against Hamas. So there is a fair amount of consistency overall here, although Israel appears to be a little more popular. 2/3 of voters think Republicans should hold up aid to Ukraine and Israel until they get additional border funding. Now, this is interesting.
That is interesting.
Because even 51% of Democrats say that they should hold
there's
up.
There's a lot of Democrats in Arizona and parts of Texas.
Yeah,
California.
Of course, it's 83% for the GOP, but it's also 61% for independents. But it is a 50-50 split with a slight majority, although within the margin of error, that even Democrats say they should hold up this aid until we get added border security funding. Now, whether that they do anything with that border security funding, I, you know, don't know. But that tells you how much more focused the American voter is and should be, in my view. Excuse me, in my view, on what's going on the border than they are with these foreign policy issues.
Well, it seems like people are also kind of in tune with, you know, sending money to Ukraine. Well, what's that getting us? We don't seem to have a very good idea of what it is that money is being used for, if it's being used effectively.
And by the way, the Democrats in Congress are preventing us from finding that out.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which I think is an indication that they know that a significant amount of that money is being siphoned off.
Yeah, they don't want the other side to have a fact-based argument. So, you know, without being able to get to the facts, then Democrats can just run around saying, well, it's just because you support Russia. That's the only reason. You hate democracy. That's why you MAGA people are so extreme.
Yeah, exactly. Because if they say, okay, we want this vetted and we want an audit done of where every penny of that money went, what we're going to find out is we're not going to be able to track about a third to a half of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. I suspect. And again, that's just me suspecting things.
You suspector.
Yeah. Which, by the way, if we were on the other side and we were supporting Russia, I would fully expect a third or a half of that money to be siphoned away by Russian oligarchs too.
Yeah, not a lot of difference there.
Yeah, we're talking
I mean,
about.
Who did the Ukrainians learn it from?
Yeah, we're talking about two of the most corrupt countries in the world. I mean, Russia is a country where the general who runs the procurement department for the Russian Ministry of Defense has a $23 million dacha outside of Moscow. So, yeah, anything that we send over there, half of it's going to get stolen, unless we had our own people over there disbursing that money. But you know what? Even if we bought them, even if we gave it to them, not as money, but in kind,
In kind, right.
how much of, so let's say we give them a whole bunch of 81 millimeter mortar shells, right? Here's 10,000 81 millimeter mortar shells. How many of those would wind up getting sold in Africa?
Yeah, that's the problem.
I'm just asking the question. So when we talked about this, about the voters being more upset about the border or thinking that we should shut off aid to those countries until we get an agreement on border funding. Well, here's the reason why. One in two voters, so 52% of voters say that immigration is a very serious issue, and also say that it has increased. 66% say that illegal immigration has increased over Biden's term. This is what we call a blinding glimpse of the obvious. However, even at that, most voters underestimate the amount of illegal border crossing. Everybody says it should be cracked down on, but they don't even realize how many people are coming in. Because if you ask them, how many border crossings by illegal immigrants do you think are occurring each year? The bell curve result is between 100,000 and 250,000. Well, I got bad news for you. Over 3.2 million came into the United States over the 12-month period ending September 23, and 400,000 have crossed since then. S given these numbers, should the administration continue its current policies or issue new, stricter policies to reduce the flow of people coming across the border? 70% new, stricter policies. That includes 55% of Democrats. And those numbers go up a hell of a lot with independents and Republicans. Is the Biden administration creating an open border, or is it just trying to enforce immigration laws more humanely? 50-50. People don't know. They do know that it is increasing the flow of drugs. Who has a better immigration policy, Joe Biden or Donald Trump? 57% Donald Trump. Although those numbers are very, very partisan in their generation. However, 60% of independents think
Yeah,
Donald
it's three
Trump,
to two.
yeah, has a better policy. The Israel-Hamas war, yeah, people generally think Israel was great. Anti-Semitism. Is anti-Semitism growing? 75% say it is growing. 65% also think discrimination against Muslims in the United States is growing.
Not true.
So, yeah, there's a lot of both sidesism right there. Is anti-Semitism prevalent in university campuses? 68% say yes. Are Jewish students being harassed? 76% say yes, they are.
So at least the people are mostly aware.
Yeah, and again, is anti-Semitism present? Well, yeah, 63% of, I mean, it's largely in line. It's not age. There's not a lot of age difference here, other than people who are above 55 years of age. So these numbers for young people, yeah, there's a lot of anti-Semitism on campus. 63% say so. 68% say Jewish students are facing harassment. Okay. Great.
There was no follow-up question of whether that was good or bad, though.
Well, yeah, that's an
I mean,
interesting question.
that might explain some of the agreement that there is definitely anti-Semitism on campus.
So, if a student calls for the genocide of Jews, should that student be told they're free to call for genocide, or should such students face actions for violating university rules? Young people, they are free to call for genocide. 53%, 37% on the 25s to 34s. Does protesters calling for the genocide of Jews constitute hate speech? Well, 70% say yes, it does. Now, that's an interesting dichotomy among young people. And by the way, pretty consistent all the way across, all the way up to 54-year-olds, or all in the 70s. So calling for the genocide of Jews is hate speech. However, they're free to do so, although most think they should face actions for violating university rules. So 53% say you're free to call for genocide, and 70% say, but doing so is a hate is hate speech.
I don't know. I mean, that sounds pretty correct in my opinion. I mean, you should be allowed to say it, but you are going to run afoul of some rules on private spaces.
Yeah, well, over 4 in 5 thinks calling for a genocide of Jews is harassment. Who do you think is responsible for the anti-Semitism on campus? 24%. It's always been there.
Well, that doesn't really explain anything, but it's true.
Yeah, it just exists in the, you know,
in the ether.
Yeah, in the luminiferous ether of the university. Students, they say, are responsible for 20%, university presidents, 11%, the left wing, 18%, how you discriminate between students and left wing political movements. I'm not entirely sure. And then 8% say, oh, it's none of these things. Okay. Most voters say the university presidents did not go enough to, you know, condemn anti-Semitism on their campuses. And of course, Liz McGill no longer at UPenn because of her answers. And a majority thinks that she should have resigned, by the way. So apparently she was just fulfilling the will of the people. 2/3 of voters believe identity politics based on race has come to dominate U.S. universities. Well, it's nice to see that 2/3 of people seem to realize what is going on. 2/3 of voters oppose that ideology, although, again, as we saw earlier, 79% of 18 to 24 support that. And again, same thing, whether Jews are the oppressors, same things, but we talked about that earlier. And then this is the Israel-Hamas war. I'm sure that many people have different opinions about that. I'm not really interested in going into all of that as a foreign policy exercise. So most people think Hamas is bad and that Hamas is full of bad people. Well, I find that difficult to argue with, but anyway, that's the poll. The two things that jump out at me is immigration is important and that nobody wants another Trump-Biden presidential campaign.
Yeah. I think that's encouraging. Like I said before, I mean, I think it's encouraging that people are seeing fairly clearly through all the propaganda and, you know, administrations put on by the various, you know, parties and entities that prefer a certain outcome. So people are rather clear-eyed, which makes me somewhat hopeful that they're less susceptible than they were to, you know, being manipulated. It's at least a start.
Yeah, it's a start. Whether it will be translated into any sort of realistic political action, I guess we'll wait and see. However, with that in mind, I think we're pretty much done for today and done for the year. Michael, have a great Christmas and New Year's. I will look forward to seeing you after that.
Yeah, see you next year.
Yeah, that's one of the times you can say that without it being you know, like a long time. Yeah, I'll see you next year, buddy.
It's the best dad joke.
Have a great holiday. And for the rest of you, by the way, also have a great holiday. We will look forward to speaking with you again when we come back after the Christmas hiatus. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. We'll look forward to seeing you on the 7th of January when we return from our hiatus. Until then, so long.